You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. Now, I'm a huge fan of lacrosse and their Alpha Burly Pros, but this year I tested their new Navigator series. And in this Navigator series, they have the Windrose and the Atlas. I use the Atlas for most of my whitetail season, a lot of scouting, a little bit on my western trips, and fell in love with this boot. Easy to break in, very comfortable, very waterproof, and it lived up to that lacrosse name. Lacrosse has been doing it for over 100 years, and the way they're going to be doing it 100 more. If you want to find out more information on the Navigator series or any of lacrosse boots, visit lacrossefootwear.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right.
We're back in black.
That's right. Sounds like I can barely hear myself, but all right, so here we go. Here's a question for you. Would you rather consult properties in the summer, let's say early summer, late spring, or in the dead of winter?
Dead of winter.
I see that we get this question a lot. We've gotten it more lately. What's the best time? And the winter's awesome. No ticks and the heat and, you know, we consult all the way down in Texas. And so May may be brutally hot down there.
Easy.
But to me, it kind of depends on the scenario or the place. Do I want to go to Minnesota in the winter? No. I'd rather go there in the spring. Do I want to go to Texas in the spring? No. I want to go there in the winter. And so the reason I ask you that is because I'm curious, because sometimes it's like, oh, it'd be great to go this time of year. You know, we're at a it's a slow time of the year. It's a great time of the year to see property. It's a slow time of the year as far as hunting. So it's a great time to go. But
the only issue I think that we have with winter time is just the inconsistency of the weather.
Oh, it's awful.
And I guess it was in December, mid-December. Kyle, Frank, and I, we went to Kansas, but we were kind of we had to travel through a snowstorm. I don't mind consulting in snow. That's not an issue. It's just the
deep
getting
snow
there.
is a different thing. Like, I don't mind a few inches. Like, I like to see what our ground cover looks like. So if it's a few inches, it's totally fine. But if it's a foot, yeah, that sucks.
that gets really tough just to navigate and walk a property, because that's the other question we get a bunch is, how much do you guys want to see of it? Like, how in depth are you guys? Just driving roads? Do you want to see the property? Want to see the neighborhood? No, it's like, I want to see this thing. I want to get out and I want to walk it. I want to walk out the points. I want to walk out some bottoms. That's the only way you're going to get a good understanding of the property itself. And being wintertime, you may not have to step on every single acre to be able to see it.
Absolutely.
So you're kind of a little bit more efficient, I think.
We use OnX tracker when we're consulting, and specifically mainly so we can track out the roads. But if we do so much walking and poking our head in that, I was using the analogy the other day that it's almost like we put a tracker on an armadillo. And you notice how armadillos just meander and wander and get lost. That's what ends up when I leave. It's a zigzag blue line pretty much across the property. And
but somehow it all ends up making sense in the end.
Yeah, there is a method to the madness. Yeah.
But
so
it's definitely necessary.
It's mid-January. We're coming up on we've got several events coming up. We've got the National Wild Turkey Federation National Convention at Gaylord Opryland in Nashville, Tennessee, coming up in mid-February. We will be there. We'll have a podcast booth. We'll be kind of in a once we know where we're going to be, we'll announce it on this podcast. They're kind of working through some details, but we're definitely going to be there in kind of a row of podcasting booths, which will be a lot of fun.
13th through the 15th.
Okay, and so we've got several consults lined up after that, but February is going to be a busy month for us. But we've got the big event in Nashville. So hopefully you guys, if you're anywhere in the area, this is one of those events you have to experience at one point in your life, because it is 50,000 people walking through all thinking turkeys. And, it's pretty amazing. It's one of my favorite shows. So hopefully you guys will join us there. And then of course we'll be at QDMA, Whitetail Weekend in March.
In March.
Tickets go on sale a little bit later, maybe this week, you said, but we will be there. So just start planning ahead if you're down anywhere. You're focused on whitetails. Join us for the Whitetail Weekend at QDMA headquarters in Athens, Georgia.
That'll be a fun one for sure.
Oh, man. So it's been a super busy week. The last three podcasts, or two last week and then one this week, with Chad and I. Matt's been traveling, consulting in Ohio and West Virginia.
Yes.
And covered how many properties?
Oh, maybe five or six on different ones.
So how many were returning visits?
Three.
Three returning visits.
And two brand new ones.
Two brand new ones. So, and I don't know how many acres that was.
Me neither.
A lot.
It was a lot. It was a lot of ground.
And so he's got several things to talk about. And then I was on two consults recently, one this past week in Illinois, and then another one a few weeks back in Kansas.
Christmas. Yeah.
And so a couple different scenarios and things to talk about. So that's what we're going to hit you with this week. And we are going to cover some of the talking points, some of the key points, so hopefully you guys can learn from these property breakdowns.
A couple things is, as we cover such a large geographical region and range within the whitetails, what they cover, I think there's important to remember the similarities between, it doesn't matter where you're at, whitetail needs really a lot of the same stuff. Right? It may change in this distribution or whatever, but a lot of the species are really pretty similar too. You know, we can find greenbrier in Texas. We can find greenbrier in Michigan.
South Carolina.
Yeah. Everywhere we go, it's there.
I think one of the biggest differences is keying in on the stressful times.
Yes.
In the South, our biggest stress period is heat of the summer. But you go in the North, the biggest stress period is now till March or April, actually. When you have the stress of late winter. And here in the Midwest, or that mid-country region, is some years the heat may be the stress period, or
other years it may
be the ice in the winter. And so you kind of have a difference in – so our management and our technique and focusing in on what species or what type of habitat feature is going to be kind of what we key in on, whether that be woody browse or herbaceous cover. But then they're right there in the middle of the country, that Mason-Dixon line. It's like, well, we want about half of each. Yeah.
And super important.
Plan on one of them, and then if you get a whole bunch of ice, well, let's go cut some trees so we can get some buds on the ground, which is what we've been doing a lot lately. So, really, this is one thing that, shoot, might as well jump in and say it. I ran into something on one of the consults that was a really good conversation.
Where at?
Illinois.
Okay.
A really good conversation about, of course, landowners in a great mindset. He's thinking a lot about not only his deer, but his quail and his health of his forest, and trying to make it as healthy of a landscape as possible. His family lives on it. They're planting about 4 to 5 acres of pollinator blend.
Sweet.
They're planting 50 plus acres of CRP.
Nice.
Diverse mix.
Not just your big three grasses.
No.
Forbs in there.
There were some forbs and some grasses, various types in it.
Cool.
It wasn't as diverse as the goal, but the CRP contract required just these. You basically pick out of the five, and we picked the one with, that met the more of his goals than anything. So, anyway. We'll discuss that later, but on this property, one of his big things was he had this nice food plot back behind his house that he had hunted on various winds, and there was a big section just south of it that was, I mean, we're talking closed canopy, closed canopy cedar forest.
Oh, gotcha.
Monster cedars, to a point where it was like just dirt underneath it.
Yeah, dirt and needles.
Barely even any needles. It was just like the crowns of the cedar trees were what had needles. Basically, midsection and low section was just
dead limbs.
Just limbs.
That's bad.
It was really bad.
Like there's so, and I've seen this before. I know you have too. But like, if it's cold enough, there's so much. Oh yeah.
I'm showing Matt some pictures right now where it's just.
But it's like there's so much dirt exposed that like when it freezes, it's crunchy because you get the icicles pop up the first little layer.
Yeah.
Oh man.
And it was
that.
So here's what the kind of the thought process was. So this was a south facing slope, so an area that could receive great sunlight. It could be just phenomenal, diverse grass with mixed shrubs and even a few scattered cedars thrown in there if you want. And it could have been a fantastic south-facing slope.
Mm-hmm.
He had standing beans just north of it in his food plot.
Yep.
And then he had this desert of an area that was probably 3 to 5 acres.
Okay.
Straight cedars. And the mindset was...
But a substantial amount of land for that parcel.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so, and the reason I bring this up is it was the question of, but where do I send my wind? I always thought kind of I'll leave that, even though it's not ideal. I was leaving that to blow my wind. That way I knew deer weren't there.
Got it.
It was kind of like, but what you mentioned quail. You mentioned everything else. You want to hold more deer. This is a very decent sized property, but... It's not big enough to where we can say, okay, you've got deer that never leave your property.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can't afford not to manage it.
Why don't we manage it? And I think that's where we get this question a good bit where people ask us, well, what do you do in acres that you don't want deer to go? And my thing is, why do I not want deer there? Like, I don't manage the way we manage a property. We don't manage the landscape to be optimal hunting scenario to where we let our habitat suffer or
be neglected,
be non-existent almost because we're focused on the reward of hunting. It's we're going to maximize the landscape. We're going to manipulate the habitat features to where we can have really good hunting, but our habitat's not, we're not going into it with the selfish management style of saying, well,
hunting's first.
I could do something here, but I don't want to mess up my hunting.
Yeah.
And so
I think
vroom, chainsaw's getting fired up.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a important mindset that we don't talk about a lot, though. It's like, you know, you can't afford on a property of that size and really any size, because it is a neglect mindset of I'm going to put that to the back burner. I'm not going to touch it. I'm not going to do anything with it. But that's, I think, where the mindset of habitat management first differs from the hunting first. We care about hunting a lot. When we go to every property, we talk about hunting and hunting scenarios and setups, but that doesn't mean that you just forget about this one slope and you just don't do anything with it. It's really funny you said that cedars on that south-facing slope. How much topography was in this area?
You know, it probably changed 150 foot. In elevation from the high point to the low point.
Gotcha.
So maybe 200. I'm not real sure, but it was kind of rolling.
Yeah.
Not too far from the Missouri River, but it had some rolls to it.
So there was some. Well, you know the properties that a couple of them that returned visits of Southeast Ohio and Western West Virginia. How much topography. It's kind of very similar to where we're at right here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So pretty substantial stuff. But it was chilly when we were out there.
Yeah.
Sun was shining some of the days, some days it wasn't. But all the properties have a really strong deer population. But we would go to an area or we're traversing the property, checking it out, reviewing it, marking some areas. But it became super apparent that on some of the slopes, south facing, just the beautiful benches or beautiful points that are just so pronounced. You're like, there's ought to be a deer bedded down right there, and it's a south facing slope. But when you look at actually what's growing there, so from a topography standpoint, you'd be like,
it's great,
right?
Yeah,
you go there habitat wise and it's just choked out Virginia pine. And so from that standpoint, it's really no different what you were looking at, Eastern Red Cedar. It was so thick on a south-facing slope, it was so cold. Like, yeah. It was substantially cooler. We're talking easy 10 degrees. You stand there in the two different, in sun, out of sun, very apparent that it's much colder.
Absolutely. Same scenario that we experienced. As soon as you step in it, you're like, whoa, it's can you guys just feel it almost like we opened up the refrigerator and stepped in?
Yeah. But
it was south-facing slope.
That was the point. It's like, guys, this is such a waste. Like, deer should be all over this area right now. But they're forced to drop in lower elevation where they get a little bit of sun. But then there's other south-facing slopes, just around the hillside or the other side of the ridge where it's wide-open timber, more mature timber. But that's where we're bumping deer. They're not in great cover. They're just getting thermal radiation. So it's like, guys, imagine this south-facing slope with good cover.
Yeah. And it's
so cold. Many deer are going to be here.
In this scenario, it was like, well, if it gets really cold, it gets down in the teens, and the deer are searching for south-facing slope to where they can bed down and stay warm, they're going to have to go somewhere else, which pushes them further away from the bedding or from the food.
Or off the property edge.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Like, 'cause we're pretty close to the property line, and it was like, if they're looking for quality cover in a south-facing scenario to where they can stay warm during the day, that's not right here close to the food source.
No.
And if we're looking for that magical December 15th deer-cimber hunt where it's snowing and you're in your box blind and they're pouring into your standing beans and it's 2 hours before dark, it's not this scenario because they're having to come from somewhere else to get here.
Yep.
And that's where it's like,
that's why you can't afford to waste good space.
You can't waste space. You have to manage every acre. Now, you're not going to manage every acre every single year.
Or to the same intensity.
You don't want to go 5 years and take a whole section of your farm and say, well, it's just not great. And that's an area I really don't want deer to go.
Yeah. It probably, and I'm you'll have to back me up on this, but from the podcast you and Chad just recorded, from a fragmenting the landscape, if you're breaking it out into chunks, it's not like you're not going to touch that south facing stuff. Again, we're talking prime time bedding opportunities, but they're not there. I mean, they're just, it was a void, and it got to the point of there are so many slopes and ridges and benches. It was like, guys, when we go over this hill, we jump out, we're probably going to hear deer bounding off, or we're going to see beds. And it was just like that light bulb, south facing slope. There was actually sunlight. That's where they were. You'd see tails, and there's fresh tracks. And it's like, guys, we have to have better cover on these slopes. We cannot avoid not doing something.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was kind of the, he already had the mindset he was wanting to maximize the farm.
Yeah.
But it was just needing to figure out how we could create great bedding without to where he couldn't blow his wind down there. Because it would be a cold set, so probably a north wind.
Right.
It was like, well, what we'll do, I mean, we're talking walk out of his shop and walk 200 yards maybe and be in a blind. It's like, as long as your scent is great, you're high, it's south slope, we're going to close edge feather this whole run up to it.
Sure.
They're going to be that way. They're going to be further west to where you don't have to worry about that.
Right.
Super, just like now we've got
this is exactly what we're going to do. This is exactly how they're going to operate. Well, that's the funny thing is when you really start to walk and be in areas of topography, I think we've made this comparison. I know we've done a presentation on it, but it's like looking at your typical, let's say, crop ground where there's perfect funnels, there's, everything is just laid out. It's like, well, if you're going to kill a deer, it's going to be right there, right?
Yeah.
When I look at areas of topography, say the more eastern United States, deer, just because you have a massive slope, they're probably only going to be working certain portions of it from, like, let's say, traveling A to B. It's not like they're going to be up and down the slope all around. They're going to be on probably 10% of that slope to get from A to B. And it's like, hunting-wise, let's improve the whole slope for habitat. But if I want to hunt it, they're going to be on that bench. The only thing I really need to focus on is them and make sure I'm not, like, boogering up where they're coming from with scent and this and that, because I can cover this whole slope by watching 10%, because these funnels are so drastic. And the habitat, if you complement those funnels, it can hunt just as good, if not better, if you understand wind and thermals, as Kansas or Oklahoma. It's like, it's pretty much, I'm not saying shooting fish in a barrel, but at the same time,
put your time in, you know it's going to happen. Yeah. You're going to have a really good chance. Yeah.
But I think it's also so tempting out there to try and hunt all the wrong places.
Yeah.
Because you feel like, okay, I got big timber, got this and that. I can see so far. I need to be there where it says, really, again, to hunt, let's say, that 50 acres, you really only need to be here if you have the right habitat features on either side of it.
Absolutely.
Just be right here.
Yeah.
That's it.
And that goes with a question that I asked Chad when we kicked off the podcast, the other podcaster this week, is I think we kicked off the podcast, I asked him, do you think it's more important to have the food plot in the right place or bedding area in the right place?
Oh, yeah.
And we both were like, it's bedding area, because you could put a food plot in the wrong place, and if it's in the wrong place, 2 years later, without planting it, grows back into old field, whatever.
Yep.
But you go into closed canopy, and you cut 95% of the canopy out, and it's in the wrong spot, you're stuck with it for a long, long time. And so it's a lot more complicated than just going, well, we'll do a hinge cut area over there and a food plot there. Boom.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. It don't always work like that.
It's not like that.
If you set it up correctly, you could have great opportunities to hunt the backside of a bedding area in the mornings.
Definitely.
Hunt in between the bedding area and the food plots in the mornings and the evenings. Hunt the food plot in the evenings. Like, there's a lot of different ways you can hunt one little area on many different winds without disturbing the deer.
Yeah, that is so true.
And it comes down to, so bring this all big circle, is, man, guys, don't overlook the odd areas on your farm, the dead zones that you haven't managed. If you don't want deer there during the rut, try to make it to where it's great forage, it's great late winter food, it's got great woody browse, or it's got great herbaceous plants for late summer stress period. Maximize your farm. Look at every acre and figure out how you can make it beneficial to the wildlife.
Talked a lot about out there with several different landowners is just the ease and simplicity of old field management and converting those acres. No, it may not be a place where they're going to just dynamite bed in the wintertime frame, but you're not going to beat that vegetation during the summertime frame.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to be able to replicate or put that amount of forage per acre anywhere else with the ease of old field management.
That still has the cover aspect
of
it.
I mean, it's fantastic.
Todd Watts
for fawns.
Learned that with the Hogan property.
Preached it on this podcast, but it is that dynamic. And these properties are in and around that same exact area. You know, you can have that same expression right there as the Hogan. And you may not have that many acres, let's say, but I don't care if you're looking at a corner of a field that's 3/4 of an acre. Do it.
Because absolutely.
No other neighbor's doing it. Like, you drive out there, it's like, oh my word.
Where's that field? Where's the open acres that's 4-foot-tall vegetation?
I literally didn't see, like, any.
Yeah.
I mean, I drove. Like, I didn't fly out there. I drove. And I can't tell you how many spots or like, it was just, it's such a limiting factor. And it's like, you know, why do we're worried about, like, fawn recruitment and all this stuff and turkeys and, you know, successfully rearing broods and whatnot. It's like, man, we are just scratching the surface with the actual stuff that they need. We've been so fortunate with you know, just the ability for these species to adapt to poor habitat and make it. But really, when you think about, like, booming numbers, when do you see, or where have you seen a huge flush of turkey populations growing here in the last few years, besides take out the Wisconsin, Minnesota's doing really well. But, like, beyond there, I don't really know of any. But
No.
That habitat is so precious and is part of such an important time frame for rearing new life.
Well, I think that's the reason why that old field borderline, because when we talk, when whitetail guys talk old fields, we really talk, we're really referring to weed patches.
Yeah, that's it.
But even flip that and go with a more native landscape, because a lot of those old fields are going to be a lot more annuals, a lot more early successional plants. But you could flip that and go into, we're even missing out on the grassland aspect, more perennial, established native warm season grasses, native cool season grasses that are in that same height as the old fields. And it's no wonder that, like, Southeastern Grasslands Initiative, we've had Dr. Dwayne Estes on here in the past, but they just made this post, and we've talked about it before, but 3 million grassland birds vanished in one lifetime. And it's like, well, that's how quickly our grasslands are drying up and dying and vanishing, both with cities expanding, residential areas expanding, but also more crops, more pastures.
Yeah, the land use, right.
Land use has changed so much. And not only that, but our native grasslands are now being encroached by a lot of invasive species, a lot of native species that are encroaching, eastern red cedar being one of the big ones out west. And so there's a lot of things that are happening, and it all comes down to, we're missing that 4 foot to 2 foot growth on our properties.
Let's not get, like, just for this sake, too caught up in the actual species that are there. We could just simply go to say there's not enough cover, regardless of species, from 4 foot and down across the landscape. I don't care if it's grasses. I don't care if it's cool season natives. I don't care if it's old fields. There's just not that, like, period.
No, it's really, really short stuff or really, really tall stuff in the form of trees.
Yeah, I had this discussion with a bunch of guys, because one of the groups of or one of the new consultations, which I thought this was truly a bold yet fantastic move, it's a landowner who hired us. He invited his neighbors. Obviously, you know, no charge, nothing. But he was like, listen, I'm an open door policy, guys. This is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
It's only advantageous for me to let you know, so that hopefully this encourages you and educates you to do similar stuff, because I'll win too.
Yeah.
And I was like, that takes a lot of guts to do that.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
Congratulations. But this goes back to, okay, 4 foot and down. Look at the shape and just, like, the anatomy of a deer. If you look at it, it's like 4 foot. Where does that put you? About chin high.
Yeah.
A deer can scan, smell, hear everything above that height, but everything important is, like, totally protected.
Yeah.
It's like, how much more important do you need to put on it? It's, you know, increasing daylight activity, food availability. It's so easy. It's just like, it's so apparent when you look at the actual, just the body shape of, when they're not giraffes, right?
No.
I mean, they're deer 4 foot and shorter. That's what's important to them. That's what we need to be managing and focusing on. And Lord have mercy, Ohio and West Virginia needs to get after it. But
and every other state that we've ever visited,
that's true,
minus
too.
Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And parts of Kansas.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that, too, is just one of those things where if you really wanted to simplify it and just say, how can I make this as diverse as possible? Well, just take – and you had – if you bought an old baseball field or a football field and all it was nothing, just look for species that fill that gap from 2 foot tall to 8 foot tall. So go with shrubs that you're very tall –
Tallest. From like the 10 to 12 foot range. That's it.
And then go down to your partridge pea or Illinois bundleflower, which is going to be a little bit shorter. And then everything in between.
Two,
add
3 foot
that.
Range. Yeah.
And you're going to have a fantastic property.
Super, super attractive to tons of different wildlife if you do that. Like, I know we've probably debated it, and we're getting a little off topic from some of the things we want to cover. But it's like, how easy is it to take an old cattle farm or just a farm that's just open and make it really good.
Oh, yeah.
It's so easy. It's Laddie so responsive.
Was a great,
oh,
great
man.
Guy.
Yeah.
And that's a property in Delaware that yeah. he converted crop field to.
Crop fields into just divert everything imaginable yeah. is there. And it's like, go back and check out that podcast. Listen to him talk. Listen to Todd about converting his pasture fields. We've talked about it
all over. So I've got a story. We're going to tie this in now to where. So what Laddie did, he planted trees.
In a crep program
that when you look at the aerial, I look at it and I'm like, 15 years, we may be going, okay.
We're doing
there might be a
management.
Little bit too many trees yeah, here starting yeah. to get a little close canopy. So property I worked in Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So it's Kansas.
Yep.
Now, granted, it's southeastern Kansas, Bourbon County. And this property had
and this
all
was
these
all,
tree
this was all done
programs put
pre.
In pre-owner,
yeah,
current
yeah,
owner,
right?
To where we have areas that could be CRP.
Right.
That are 30-foot tall pin oaks.
Sycamores.
And cottonwoods and sycamores.
Cypress, too, right?
He had a full cypress grove in Kansas. I mean, he was like, we were looking at, we're like, what in the world? And he
who
goes,
was
so here's the story.
Yeah.
The previous landowner loved trees. So
why buy
instead
Kansas?
Of moving to a place that has trees, he tried to bring the trees to his place in Kansas.
Did you
and
tell him
like,
to swap land?
It was like, you know, that kind of thought to me, we've preached this so much. It's like, you know what? If you love quail, move to where there's quail.
Yeah.
Don't try to bring them someplace they're not. You're going to constantly be fighting it. So, like, this guy planted these trees. Not the current owner, not our client, but previous landowner.
Now
he
he's
planted
just
all
dealing
these
with
trees.
It.
Now he's dealing with it. And he's going, I'm trying to convert forest back to grassland like it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to go through and do all this additional work and expense to get rid of these cypress tree. We're not getting rid of the cypress because it is a wetland area.
Okay.
And it's really it's a really boggy down
yeah,
area.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
the least of our worries.
Right.
Deer are using it. It's helping with this wetland because he would like to have some ducks possibly.
But that's a very small unit out of the yeah. remainder. What was
I mean? We're talking probably 50 plus acres.
Oh Lord.
If not more. I mean, we're talking. I've got stories on stories of pin oak rows out through the middle of old field where you're like,
my
well,
stomach's upset.
Here's what's amazing about it.
How old?
So
how
the
long
contract's
ago?
Over.
Yeah, so he's free to do whatever.
So, now Kyle Hedges was there with me.
Yeah.
You look at these random rows going out through, and they're all 30-foot tall pin oaks, which have lots of limbs,
yep.
which
oh,
hold
yeah.
their leaves really well. Oh, man, it's going to be great. Instead of cutting treetops and dragging them out in the field, he'll just be able to go through and vroom, 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 drop them all, Covey headquarters, boom.
Mm-hmm.
Woody structure.
Right.
So it'll be great. It's like that previous landowner
what
planted them going, okay, in 30 years, this guy will be able to make quail habitat with these. Now, he didn't have that in mind, but that's
no.
what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But we got other areas where complete 30-acre to 50-acre fields are straight – trees in rows. Here's the worst part. The previous people, a lot of the neighbors say that that was some of the best crop fields. So it's
right,
like really
right,
good
right,
soil.
Right.
So it was crops previously, but not sure if he planted grass and then planted these trees, but there's a lot of fescue underneath
mm-hmm.
them. So another non-native.
Right.
And now there's a lot of, because of the lack of herbicide on noxious weed control, it's like cerisa everywhere underneath.
Everywhere.
So you've got cerisa, you've got turf grass fescue
yeah.
to cerisa to tall trees shading everything out.
It's like you start at the bottom of most, you know, easy to deal with, and then you just climb a level
yeah.
of difficulty and
yeah.
crap, and then climb another level.
Yeah.
Oh,
and then
man.
So it's like, okay, so there's maples. There's things we can do right away. We can cut
yeah.
in some bedding thickets and make it great cover,
right?
Great bedding. But long term, his plan, he wants more quail.
Yeah.
And it's like point at those fields and go, well, we ain't going to get them with that.
That's the white elephant in the room.
So it's like, okay, I hate to tell you this, but, oh, man, we're going to have to get in, take care of those trees.
Then address Sarisa.
And then we're going to plant crops to get rid of all the Sarisa, to get that out of the system for a little while. Then turn around and plant straight grasses, probably the big three grasses, and spray another round to give the grasses plenty of time to thicken up, and then we'll add more forbs and other diverse blends later into that. But it's a long process, but this landowner's ready to tackle it. One of the areas
it's gonna take years,
was,
unfortunately, but
one of the areas was so big and vast that it was like borderline walk out in the middle of it, put a blindfold on and go,
Where am I?
Like if you ever get out in the middle of a cornfield and you're like, I don't know which way to go. Almost like that, where you're like,
oh, man.
And it was like, oh, man, 70%+ cottonwood. Where you're just like, what is going on here?
Who approved this?
Yeah, it really was. Like, man. What NRCS agent approved this,
man,
this
that's
planting?
That's disheartening.
And, but you know what? The landowner's ambitious. He's going to take care of it.
That's exactly
right.
But
it's just like, golly, I wish I was here 40 years ago to say, no, heck no.
This
is bad. This is terrible, terrible, terrible. Landowners are still seeing quail. Now he's got a couple of coveys. We actually jumped a really big covey.
That's awesome.
While we were on the property. And it's like,
there's hope.
They're there. There's enough hope, enough coveys to go, okay, we can do something.
Yep.
But it's like, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, there should be a lot more coveys because we're going to take care of the Sarisa. We're going to get back into more diverse, like one whole pasture field that was a lot of smooth brome and fescue had been ungrazed for a while and mowed a little bit, but no herbicide added. And it's just like Sarisa, so thick through it. And it's like, we got to convert that to crop just to take care of it first.
Just to clean the seed bed out
and then
go back in and get what you want.
Yeah. So he'll be planting some natives in the future and doing some CRP programs. And, Sarisa and trees. It's like, I'm in Kansas right now? Like,
well,
what a time to be alive.
Let's put that into perspective. There's a big slope in West Virginia on one of these farms that was it was old pasture, and now had grown up back into some forest on some of the units, but it's about 30, 40 acres or so. It's a big old slope. And everything underneath of it, though, is like 100% autumn olive.
Oh.
Like, so bad, you can't walk through it.
Oh.
And it was to the point where it's a steep enough slope that there's like one, two benches, maybe. And it was landowner was interested in doing some logging operation on the portion of the farm, but there were still some values still remaining on this slope, and it was like, okay, we can't turn away from this just monster thicket of olive. You have to attack it, but how are you going to attack it? How are you going to take a bite out of this and chip away?
We're going to have prescribed fire. We're going to get Tyler Ross up there, get him on the radio.
Yeah.
Broken arrow. Yeah. Bomb the place.
Just bomb it all.
Yeah.
But it was basically kind of similar to your situation is literally this is a multi-step process, but we had to come in, let's log it, which typically we're like, add more sunlight. But this is just going to allow skidders to get in, get those benches back open where a guy can get in there and actually apply herbicide. Like, literally, you can't walk, much less get a buggy or UTV side-by-side in there to spray and address these things. I mean, if you tried to cut with a chainsaw on that, it would be horrendous.
Ugh.
And I don't mind cutting with a chainsaw.
So is it
going to
be like basil
unreal.
Spraying, like spraying stumps? And
that and foliar application.
Oh, my gosh.
Working a bench.
Yeah.
Just kind of spraying on top and just
– yeah. Try to get a fire,
let it
knock
rain.
Fire it out. And
then at that point, once he gets comfortable with fire after a couple of years, you can go back in because there's no value of trees left on that acreage. You can get more intense with a fire and
how
let that
come
back.
How big are these autumn olives?
Pop.
Like, we're looking at the stumps, like, or the trunks.
They just, every single size you can imagine.
Oh,
there's new sprouts. There's giants.
Like, so the you almost are like, well, maybe the guy to buy this farm or the person, the perfect marriage of this farm would a man who owns a land clearing business that's got a grinder head that can sit out here and piddle for 2 months and just throw chips everywhere.
But the percent on some of those slopes is like, I wouldn't dare put a piece of equipment on it.
Oh, man.
So it's like you every which way you kind of try to turn or like, okay, we'll use this technique. It's like, well, you run into this roadblock, and then you run into that roadblock. And it's like, we're going to have to wipe this slate clean.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Unfortunately. But
that's where –
again, he's like, if that's the way we need to do it, we're doing it. We're going to do it.
Yeah.
Which kudos to him and kudos to your gentleman there in Kansas that you visited.
Yeah.
It's not an easy road, but it's a road that you have to take.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, it goes back to that, man, this is so much why I hate non-native introduction, especially non-natives that are relatively new and we don't know about.
Right.
We've been on properties where autumn olives were planted during the time frame when they weren't considered invasive.
Right.
And, you know, they plant fence rows to make screens, or they plant hedgerows to make quail cover.
Yeah.
Like the perfect tree for quail. Lots of berries, lots of protection, and grows fast. Ooh, that sounds amazing. That
sounds dangerous.
Yes. Anything that grows fast always scares me.
No, it sounds too good to be true.
Yeah, usually is.
Mama warned you about stuff like that.
And it's like, so Cerisa lespediza introduced under the mindset that this was going to be great erosion control, but also be great for quail, which were declining at that point. Oh, yeah. Well, that was a horrible mistake. Autumn olive will be introduced as a very native hedgerow that will be great for fence lines great for cattle, multi-floral rows, mm-hmm. same thing.
Yep.
Horrible mistakes. And it goes back to, we're not owners of the land. We're just borrowing it from the next generation.
Yeah,
and
for
so
sure.
Do you wipe the slate clean? We've all passed. Which side of history do you want to be on? Do you want to be on the side that says, I made it better for the next generation? Or I got selfish and did something for me
mm-hmm.
that the other guy is going to have to deal with?
Yeah, for sure.
And I feel like, that, bless his heart,
yeah,
I'm sure he didn't think what he was doing was a big deal. But when he planted all those trees in an area that should have a lot more grass.
That was prairie.
A big mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge mistake. What is that from? That's from a movie. I saw it on The Office.
Gotcha.
Big mistake. Huge mistake. He made this. He went in and planted something that he liked but wasn't good for that area. And to where now, it's not even great for the deer because it's too thick, too rank. It's horrible for the quail. It's not great for the turkeys. It's like, what are we doing here?
Even though there's stuff there, it's a wasteland.
Autumn olive drives me nuts. It's not great for deer. There's better options. Get it out of here. It's not supposed to be here. Get it out of here. I might as well say it. Miscanthus gigantus. It's just a screen. It
grows too fast.
It grows really fast. Woohoo! But it's for a screen. Don't try to tell me it's habitat or does any benefit for native species.
It's benefiting
us. It's only for you and your access and screen.
Yeah.
Don't.
There's other ways to go about
it.
Don't
pee on me and tell me that it's rain. That's what Chad says.
Yeah.
So,
The other thing
is, don't give me gravy and tell me that it's jelly because I know gravy ain't sweet.
When going back into the, let's say, the introduction of those species, autumn olive, multiflora rose, it was like, what can I do? What can I bring in to fix this solution?
What's the easy fix?
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, that's not the mindset that hopefully guys were presenting here. Is the mindset is diversity. If you're trying to find one single species to solve a problem or solve an issue, you're going about it wrong.
You're going to have to look hard.
It's going to cause a problem because it's not going to fix the problem. And then it's going to cause more work down the road. The solution is diversity. And that, when we look in nature, that's always been the answer.
Yeah, absolutely.
It always has, for every species.
If you find a species of plant that grows really fast and spreads really quickly, maybe it is beneficial to one species. Chances are that's only beneficial. That may only give cover, but not food. So if you had that across the whole landscape, they'd have to go somewhere else for food. That's why diversity is key.
Yes.
Because you can get food, you can get cover for year round. That's for year round cover and year round food. That's why diversity is a must. We have to go back to natives first and diversity. Now, yep. Sure, you can supplement with food plots, but you should be managing your property in a way that if you don't plant food plots that year, your wildlife are still going to be just fine.
Totally good.
Yeah.
Maybe you go on a mission trip. Maybe you get shipped overseas.
So
maybe
here's my call to action and challenge for you guys. Think about your farm, and if you walked away for 1 year and you didn't plant your food plots, what would your deer eat?
And I'll say this. If your food plots that you walked away from that reverted into annuals is the best, not saying that that's not good, but if that's the best, then you got a lot of other work to do in a lot of other areas.
Oh, so bad. I'll use this. So I'm guilty of this. A lot of times I try to maximize food plots and go try to make them as big as possible. And over the years, there's been portions where little bitty slivers and back ends, little coves off the food plot that is like, man, I'd like to get something to grow. That'd be great if it's clover. Now it's like, you know what? Dormant season disking. Just try to get some forbs, some ragweed growing. That's going to be better than some non-native that's growing there.
Heck, I don't care. Broom sedge grows up there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no forage, but it's decent cover, decent edge.
Yeah, it's
edge,
a lot better for
right?
quail.
Sure.
So, yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, we're firing up the tractor and getting the disc, and we're going to do some dormant season disking in some of these areas. It's like, we need to diversify. We need to change it.
Well, and truthfully, you've experienced it enough where that corner, the actual production is super, super thin.
Oh, it's,
I mean, it's yeah, horrible. It's not worth your time.
It's not worth putting fertilizer and lime on it. Not worth the seed, not worth the time dragging the drill over it. Just disc it and call it good.
Move on. It's fine. It'll be fine.
And we'll do our typical, we'll pick some bags of our, we'll just take some bags or get some seed from Pure Natives and broadcast it out there and call it good, you know? Just throwing seed out on the ground and hope that we can get something to grow over time. And eventually we'll get something to spread. Like, that's how Eastern Gamma Grass is on the old orchard mm-hmm. food plot. As we had one native clump and we just continued to
picked
grab this,
a little bit every year,
threw it over there. And it wasn't like a CRP field where we had a whole bunch of seed going to ground, but eventually we got a few more clumps. So
it takes time to develop all that stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, I thought about it honestly on the ride back quite a bit and in talking to some of those guys who were, let's say, in West Virginia versus Ohio. Because if you think about it, Southeast Ohio versus the portion of West Virginia where we work quite often, virtually the exact same.
Yeah.
The only thing that's different is the river that splits the two. And it's like,
one's a Buckeye and one's a Mountaineer.
Yeah. There's probably a lot of people arguing right now. They don't like that discussion. I just had. Let's just focus on the habitat.
Yeah.
Habitat is like the exact same. The same exact species are growing in the same exact ways, and the land use is extremely similar. But if you were to ask somebody, would you rather go and hunt Ohio versus West Virginia, what are they going to say?
Ohio.
And the important factor to take away from this is age structure is so important if you're wanting to grow big deer. Like that's a big thing for people and a lot of the clients that we have. Guys, I want to see bigger deer. I want to see more deer, but I want to see bigger deer. When you look at these two states, one's a one buck state, one you can kill 3 bucks, rifle season's open. And I'm not getting into this big debate about what regulations the state could, should, would have, this and that. But it simply is, we have two states, same habitat. Southeast Ohio does definitely still produce some really big deer. We've got people who are killing great deer there. And the same quality of habitat. But they have more opportunities.
West Virginia.
North
Carolina. In my head, you said South Carolina, okay. But maybe I'm wrong.
If
it's late.
If those factors are the exact same of habitat, terrain, all this stuff, the resources are there, why is Ohio killing bigger deer than West Virginia? It's just the opportunity that there's more deer getting to older age in Ohio in the same ground. Well, West Virginia has the exact same potential to grow the exact same quality of deer that Southeast Ohio is doing because the resources are the same. The age structure is completely different. Yeah. Going through chill cameras with these landowners like, okay, got it. That's where you're at. That's what we got. You know, we're searching for this. We're trying to grow this. Well, we need cover. We need this. Go to Ohio. Wow. It's like a reminder of just how important getting deer to age is.
If your goal is big deer.
Right. If that's your goal, there's not really a big substitute because some of the properties there working in Ohio is brand new to land management. It's not like it's like I've been working on this farm for 10 years. Here's this fantastic quality. It's surrounded by national forests, which we all know. I mean, it's like pretty poor habitat, but still having potentials at 160, 170 inch deer right there across the river, 10 miles from guys who are struggling to find a 3.5-year-old on the landscape. It's like the only difference is the age structure.
Yeah.
The age structure is dictated by whether you pull
West
a trigger.
Virginia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Same thing. West Virginia, you can bait. Ohio, you can bait. So guys, number one, habitat is super, super important. But I think one of the second biggest things, genetics got brought up.
Oh,
well, what
man.
Do you think about our genetics? Guys, I don't care about your genetics until you have nutrition addressed on the property, and then you have the right age structure. Most people are worried about number one.
And then
you
have
get
a high
to number
fence.
Two. And then you get to number two, and at that point, once you have the age structure built in and you have the right nutritional property, you could care less about genetic because it doesn't even matter anyhow. You're all giving the same thing. They're all dispersing. It doesn't matter. Just worry about the habitat, the nutritional aspect, and the age structure, and you're going to have what you want.
Yeah.
The river is not changing the two opportunities. It's simply the age structure between the two states that's regulated by hunting regulations. That's it. So I don't care where you're at because we've been a bunch of different places.
You could take that same comparison with southern Iowa and northern Missouri.
Exactly. The state line doesn't change anything besides the opportunity. Yeah, besides regulations.
Yeah.
You have to be able to, if that is your goal, resist pulling a trigger and resist saying, well, the neighbor's going to kill him. Well, maybe he does, but maybe he doesn't.
Yeah.
What if he doesn't?
You'll never know
now
if you
shoot
have,
him. Yeah, now you have the chance.
Yeah.
And I don't care if your goals aren't to shoot big deer. Cool. Do what you do. But if it is, these are the facts. Like, you have to be able to get them or try and work with neighbors to provide that age structure locally in your neighborhood. Four counties in southern West Virginia, you cannot shoot a rifle in.
Yeah.
It's bow only for counties.
Studs.
Horrible habit. I mean, we're talking reclaimed coal ground, bad. There's some timbering operations stuff down there, but like generally speaking, pretty poor habitat. Mountain deer. Studs.
Yeah.
And they're like, how are they killing them down there? Well, they're killing them because they're there.
Yeah.
Not because of any other reason. Yeah. If they were here, you'd kill them too. But they're just not, you just don't even have the opportunity to.
Yeah.
Because you don't have deer at 4.5 years old.
So then take that into habitat too. It's like, okay, well, my number one thing is let them get older.
Sure.
Okay, well, do you want them to get older? Provide the groceries and the habitat that allows them to spend as much time possible on your place.
Bingo.
So they have a better chance at surviving.
Exactly.
Rather than have to go to Tom, Dick, or Harry's property.
Yes.
During the rut or during a part of the season when your property doesn't provide that and they get shot there when they're a 2.5-year-old.
Yeah.
Tom, Dick, or Harry's thrilled about it.
congratulations.
Congrats to them. But if your goal is big deer, maximize your habitat and manage your trigger finger.
You don't have to, like, let's say, practice to get an age structure. Don't hunt for 3 years. I'm not saying that that's a practical thing, but I'm just saying, like, by default or just by being absent, you're going to get older deer if you're not, you know, shooting them, right? That's just simple.
Yeah.
But habitat, you got to work at. You got to do it. And the combination of the two will help you get to your goals a lot faster. The thing about, I guess, habitat management is once you have deer at, like, 4.5 and you're average deer is 150, right?
Yikers,
habitat management is taking that 150-inch average and moving the needle up to 170 to 180-inch deer. That's the difference, habitat management. If you can even have age structures, right?
Ooh, those are some high averages. Let's say you have a 120 average, and then you fix the habitat, and you go, oh, now my average is 140. Well, that's to say the Michael Jordans, the genetic freaks of your deer herd, go from peaking out at 160 to
touching 200.
Sky's the limit. We don't know. Yeah. That's why I always ask the question, okay, well, Southern Iowa is known for giant deer. Well, the habitat sucks, so let's fix
the
habitat.
Not great.
Let's just paint a big 80-grit swath across Southern Iowa and say, you get a chainsaw, you get a drip torch, you get a drip torch, everybody gets good habitat. And then we go, okay, wow, I don't even want to watch those videos coming out of there because it's just going to make me mad.
It's going to be scary. There's points everywhere.
And that's the case in much of the whitetails world is habitat's poor.
Michigan,
and we still
Michigan
have
had a client this year shoot a, what was it?
157, I thought.
I think, yeah, right under 160.
4.5.
Yes.
4.5. And I believe wholeheartedly that you typically, speaking on just the whole herd, we don't know a buck until he's 5.5, because donuts changed that mindset for me. 4.5, we know, we have a pretty good idea. But donuts was a really nice 3.5-year-old 8-pointer, a really nice 140 8-pointer at 4.5, and then he blew into a mainframe 11-pointer 170-inch deer.
And you're saying 5.5?
Five and a half.
You don't know what he's going to be at 6.5.
You don't know. But, like, I grew up and I worked with Mark Drury, and then I've heard Lee Lukoski, and they've always said 5.5. And, of course, 5.5 is just a – I will shoot a 4.5. Heck, I'd have even shot many 3.5-year-olds and been
– tickled pink.
Tickled pink. But you always raise the question, what would they be at 5.5? Now, I think like Jason Brosda's deer, our Michigan guy, his deer is a stud 4.5-year-old, 157. Oh, my gosh. Michigan? Are you kidding me? We posted that, and people were, like, sharing it. I saw lots of guys from Michigan liking the page
that don't
follow our page.
Yeah.
It was like, woo, you know that deer made some rounds, to where people are like, did he really kill that in Michigan?
And you can
grow big deer in Michigan.
Well, I love that property. I mean, that's a really, really cool property.
You know what that property has, and I'm talking to our audience, our listeners right now. You know what that property has that a lot of Michigan doesn't have?
I know what you're going to say.
An active logging operation. Lots of timber on the ground.
And
a client who is willing to eat a couple of tags and let deer get old.
And
older.
Cover from 4 foot down.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
He's got that 2 to 4 foot range.
Covered. I mean, it's awesome.
And you know what client's doing? That a lot of guys in Michigan aren't?
I know.
He's cutting on them all and killing it.
He's
getting it out of there.
Yeah. Waging war.
Yeah.
On autumn olive. There's so many good things I think we could continue talking about.
What's some other stuff that kind of keyed up highlights for you?
Gosh, the need for timber work, truthfully. Yeah. A lot of things had just been abandoned, and it's okay from a standpoint of, listen, I don't want you to go in there and do it wrong.
Yeah.
And they're taking the right steps and educating themselves on what needs to get done, following the plan, implementing the plan. But truthfully, something's got to get done because
yeah,
previous owners, honestly, unfortunately, they didn't do things right.
Yeah.
And again, now it is your issue, your need to address. And maybe their goals for the property were completely different from you. That's fine. But now this is a responsibility and it's time to address it. But what I guess I found from a satisfaction standpoint or a comforting standpoint was there were some areas that on one of the farms, they call it their successional field. And it had like the perfect blend for the Eastern United States of all the species that you wanted. It's like, fantastic. Guys, take this and make it everywhere. Like,
yeah.
This is really good. When you, if you need a judge or like something to compare your other sites to, come back to this and make sure you get familiar. Because this right here, if you put this on, let's say, the interior versus the boundary of your property, if you have this type of cover and forage available, wow, you're going to be doing some stuff.
Yeah.
But replicate this, and here's how you do it. Here's what you do.
Yeah.
And they're go-getters out there. Basically, everyone I talked to out there was like, man, I cannot wait. I'm doing it. This is awesome. I'm doing it. It's like a couple years from now, I wouldn't be shocked if some cool stuff comes out of areas that just are typically, let's say, underdeveloped from a wildlife standpoint.
Yeah.
Underserved.
Yeah. A couple main points for me, highlights is, you know, people that typically hire us are really, by the time they go forth and they hire us, they're really have the mindset of land health, not just kill big deer. Now, granted, mm-hmm. A lot of our clients have killed big deer and are seeing a lot of really good deer develop on their farms.
Yeah.
That I would gladly just show pictures and say, this is what can happen. But that's not our focus.
Yeah.
A lot of our clients, so these two guys that I'm referencing here, they've got the mindset. They're trying to do things right. They're trying to make it a healthy landscape, a healthy ecosystem with lots of diversity. So props, major props to them.
And those are two guys who have killed some giant deer.
Giant deer, yes. Giant deer. So I'm going to give a couple things that made me really, really happy, made my heart happy. Is one client had in Illinois had lots of crops.
Mm-hmm.
Terrain there. And,
that's what makes
and
deer
walking
big though,
out.
Right?
Yeah, that's right, crops. And walking out across this crop field, there's elevation changes.
Yeah.
And you can just see the rolls.
Yep.
And every little low spot, you see a ditch
mm-hmm.
starting to form. And I say, how often does the farmer, like, does your farmer do dirt work in the dormant season to try and fix all this? And he's like, absolutely. My farmer's really good trying to fix that, make sure he gets on. He's planted. There was wheat stubble in there where he had wheat, and then he planted double crop soybeans.
And
it was like, okay, well, he's got some. He's no tilling. But, man, those ditches, it's like you can do all the dirt work you want. But a lot of it still runs down and ends up down in the ditches.
Yep.
And that's where he's enrolling CRP. So it's like all these areas that were high
probability of erosion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's fixing.
Sweet.
And so it's like, well, you talk about seeing the covey coil as you're driving in. We're going to try to bring those down where they're catching a ride on in the back of your truck down to your good habitat.
That made me really happy. Right there.
So he's going with, now he's going to have that 2 to 4 foot growth through a lot of his landscape, through a lot of his farm. Then he's going to cut cedars, so he's going to get that old field, that grassland back.
Nice.
He's going to cut in a bunch of bedding thickets, so he's going to get that young forest. He's actually going to harvest some timber, so he's going to get a healthier forest.
Wow.
And then he's strategically placing food plots to make his hunting so much better.
Yeah.
It's like doing it right.
Putting a cherry on the top with the food plots guy. I got every other component every month of the year for all these wildlife species. I got them covered with this, and this, and that. And when I need to strike during October, November time frame, I got the little sprinkled goodies in there, and I'm good to go.
So the other client, Kansas, he's like buying a sprayer. He's getting a UTV.
Yep.
And he's ready to full-fledge attack Cerisa lespidiza.
Got
to
do it.
and the tall fescue. So he's going to go around and spray all this cool season grass and cerisa. So he's going to spray in the spring for cool season grass. He's going to spray in the summer for cerisa.
Love it.
Then he's going to start edge feathering and doing lots of timber management. He's enrolled in some TSI projects along his river. So you've got wide open river, which is now going to be thinned and have bedding thickets.
That bottom ground in Kansas can get wide
open.
Oh, my
gosh. Yeah, way too open. And so he's going to be doing lots of things with a chainsaw and a sprayer. And he's really motivated to bring some quail back. So,
well, that's encouraging to see. Did he know that he had quail on that place?
Yeah, he's already got a bird dog, too. And so hadn't done a lot of hunting, but he's already got a bird dog as a pet. And so he's wanting to bring the quail back. So
definitely.
Yeah. And lots of bramble patches, lots of shrub thickets scattered around that he's going to enhance. So
the right species are there, just not the right composition.
Yeah.
Spatially.
The ones that the right species are there, they're not flourishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The ones that are flourishing are Cerisa aspidiza.
Saw really cool thing, property in West Virginia. We're talking like center of the property, deep timber, some white pine scattered around, oaks, and there's right on this little point. It was one of those points where it's like, we're going to jump deer off this thing. Ready? Walk, I don't know, 70 yards. Sure enough, boom. We slowed down, and in the timber, there's two tiny little clumps of little blue stem. It was the only place he'd seen on the property. There was Indian grass on a field edge, but little blue stem in the timber. Like, do you guys know what this is? I'm like, I don't think I've ever seen that. I said, just wait.
Yeah.
Start doing this stuff, guys. This is what we want to see. This is like an indicator that there was sunlight here. There used to be sunlight here.
Yeah. That was property in Ohio?
West Virginia.
Oh, West Virginia. Okay.
Yep. I'm like, really? Yeah, I was like, so what you're seeing here right now didn't ever used to be like this.
Yeah.
Like, West Virginia didn't used to look like this. That's so hard to wrap your head around, though.
Yeah.
But, man, those – and it's just like, so really, you're going to tell me that little tiny piece of grass that's suffering and being choked out, that's how you know? It's like, yeah. That's how
part
I know.
Of it. It's a piece of the puzzle. That's like
– I'm right.
I don't think because that's me snapping my fingers. A lot of times we'll do this work, or I think it's like a watched pot never boils, a watched tree never grows,
or gets cut.
You just like you look at trees and you're like, man, it doesn't seem like it's really ever growing. Mm-hmm. But like if you were to go in and just take an acre and cut all the trees down and walk away, you could go and move away for a few years, come back. You'd be shocked at how quickly those – it looks more like a forest than a clear cut like you left it.
But that's the thing of it all is you have to create a disturbance to see regeneration.
Yeah.
You can't just watch things that are already 60, 70 foot tall and be like, oh, this is not growing. You cut it down to zero.
Well, I think too,
it's going to jump to 3 foot really quick, and you're like, "Oh, wow!"
If you you look at forests and they're already stacked in too many stems per acre, they don't grow nearly as fast as if you were to go in and thin that timber.
Yes.
Let's just say you take a canopy that's 95% closed, and you knock it down to 50, and you come back in 5 years, it may already be back up to 80.
Yeah.
Because those trees just start filling out and growing a lot faster. Because they have that sunlight and more nutrients. So.
You know what we don't talk a lot about on the podcast from a TSI standpoint, but in some of these areas where it was clear cut out there and you go back and it's like, okay, this was 15, 17 years ago based on stumps and tree growth and regrowth, whatever. You're like, not only is there competition for the sunlight, but do you know how much competition underneath the soil, the ground level, there is for root space?
When
you have such high stem density, there's so much competition underneath the ground. They can't even get the right footing to be able to grow and expand. So from the nutrient standpoint, it's like, guys, they don't have enough root space to grow. That's why you see stuff tipped over and falling over.
You see unhealthy trees. Yeah. And you see disease and insects start knocking out whole.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, guys, once again, we thank you so much for listening. Catch us in Nashville at National Wild Turkey Federation in February. Yep. The National Convention, catch us at the QDMA Whitetail Weekend in March.
It's going to be a lot of fun out there.
In Georgia. It'll be first time at headquarters for us, yeah. So I'm very excited about that.
We'll be speaking two different days there, too.
Yeah.
So Friday and Saturday we'll be down there.
Yeah. Well, so, guys, also getting ready to put some more videos on YouTube. So go over, search Land and Legacy on YouTube, and subscribe, please, for us. And I'm good.
Appreciate all your support. We'll see you next week.
Yeah.